My name's Tony, and I'm an alcoholic. Before I chair a meeting or tell my story, you know, I ask my higher power to use me as an instrument, you know. And before I get into the I's, me's, you know, of my story, I would like to give thanks to, you know, my higher power, these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the many men that have, you know, led me through this down this path of recovery. And you know, there's many of them. So I mean, to name just a few, I mean, I've had so many inspirational guys, and I've been fortunate that, you know, I've been around and aware of paying attention to what they're trying to pass on to me. And that's what I hope to do tonight. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. I'd like to share more, since this is, you know, treatment center, I'd like to share more of my experience, strength, and hope. And but I'd like to touch on, you know, what I was like. I was raised in Las Vegas, Nevada, so I mean, that pretty much qualifies you. And you know, growing up there, it's pretty wild. And, you know, my parents were pretty lenient. And, I mean, we basically got to do whatever we wanted. And, you know, our high school, we prided ourselves on throwing parties that were, you know, better than some fraternity parties at UNLV, you know. We took it to the limit. And, you know, from an early age, you know, my sophomore year in high school, I knew my drinking was out of control. I knew it wasn't right because, man, I was drinking more than, you know, anybody that I knew. And in the back of my mind in that day, I was like, man, I know this is, you know, damaging my body and stuff, but, you know, the rewards that I was getting, I was able to, you know, be the life of the party and you know, just become a different person, you know, in my own mind. You know, when I first came into recovery, I got to tell this story right quick. You know, I was thinking, you know, these people were talking about conscious contact with a higher power and, you know, building a relationship with a higher power, and I was like, you know, whatever. I thought it was kind of crazy at the time, you know, a conscious contact with a, you know, a higher power. And you know, I was thinking that you know, as part of a brainwashing thing, you know. And now that I've been sober a while, I look back and, you know, my first drink was the beginning of the brainwashing. You know, that first drink I ever had, you know, I felt like something was just, is, you know, it's like I found, you know, paradise. You know, this is the answer to all my problems. And, you know, at first it like many stories, I mean, the rewards were great. You know, I was able to talk. I was an introvert and, you know, pretty shy. And, you know, once I got a 2 or 3 beers in me, it was like, man, you know, I could talk to anybody. And you know, that was, you know, part of the rewards. And it's like, you know, I had a cape, you know, and I was Superman all of a sudden. But, you know, alcohol slowly took stuff away from me, you know. My, you know, I was pretty athletic, and I remember I lettered as a freshman in baseball. And then, you know, my junior year, I made all conference in football. And then my senior year, you know, I didn't, because my drinking had already taken a toll on me. It was more important than, you know, going to the gym or you know, putting in the effort and the work and maintaining, you know, my skills on the football field. And so, you know, I suffered. And, you know, looking back on it, it didn't really matter to me then. But now it's like, wow, you know, I wasted that. That's where alcohol started taking an effect on me. And, you know, after graduating, working in the casinos, and I mean, it's just a party lifestyle there, you know, when you're 18, 19 years old, and, you know, it's basically that's the road I was going down. And anyway, my story goes, like, I wound up moving to Texas in 91, and you know, my drinking kind of slowed down because you know, I started, because when you're in Vegas, you never pay for alcohol. It's, you know, I mean, you hang out at the casinos, and you know, that's where the parties are at anyway, and you know, it's free booze all the time back in the 80s. And when I moved away, you know, and had to start buying my own beer and stuff, it's like, you know, it kind of curtailed my drinking and stuff. And, you know, eventually, you know, I don't know what really triggered it, but I started drinking all the time. And eventually it got worse and worse and worse. And, you know, I didn't have no social life. I wasn't going to bars because bars were too expensive. And, you know, I was a stay-at-home drinker. And, you know, basically that's what I did. And, you know, I was still maintaining a job. I had a good job working for a grocery store doing maintenance all throughout Central Texas. And, you know, it paid pretty good. And, but anyway, my drinking started taking on a different deal, and I was starting to drink every day after work. And, you know, eventually, you know, I don't know where I crossed that line, but I did. And once I did, it was, you know, kind of all downhill from there. And I remember this one incident. I was living in Arlington, Texas, and, you know, I wasn't drunk. I got pulled over. I made an illegal right-hand turn or something, and you know, the cop comes up and he asks for my insurance and, you know, registration and my driver's license, and I gave it to him. And he goes to his car, and I guess he's running me, and he comes back out of his car with this gun drawn, and I was like, what the heck, you know? And, you know, he ran a check on me, and you know, I had gotten into some trouble in Las Vegas, Nevada, you know, as far as, and basically it was still on my record. The initial charge was still on my record, but it wound up getting dropped down to disorderly conduct. But that charge was attempted murder. And basically what had happened was I was on, you know, the Las Vegas Strip, and I got jumped by two guys, and I wound up almost killing one of them, and I was in jail for 21 days on that. But I didn't know that the initial charge stays on your record, and that's what that guy, the police officer, explained to me, and he said that's why, you know, I had my gun, and, you know, he handcuffed me until, you know, he found out that, you know, I didn't have anything, no warrants or anything. Wrote me a ticket. But, you know, it was kind of scary at that time. I was like, wow, you know, my past was pretty rough, you know, and I didn't realize that until I got out of it. You know, you don't know how bad the tornado is until it's gone and you're out of it, you know, and then you can see the devastation. Well, anyway, hold on a minute. Alcohol started taking a big toll on my life, and, you know, it was affecting me physically. And I wound up going to the hospital, and I was having DTs, and it was the first time I ever had DTs. I didn't know what was going on, you know. And I definitely wasn't going to drink anymore, because that was the little did I know, if I just drank a couple of shots, I would start feeling better. But I didn't know that. I was like, that's the last thing I want to do. And, you know, I get to the hospital and I remember them pumping me full of fluids, you know, a couple bags of saline, and sent me on my way. And I remember leaving that hospital, and I remember that feeling. I didn't feel any better than I did when I first walked in, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, that grief it was tremendous. You know, I thought this was it, you know. I'm going to wind up dying. I don't know what's wrong. They don't know what's wrong. And I felt like death, you know. I had real bad DTs, and, you know, the doctor said, you need to quit drinking so much. And so that's what I did. I quit drinking. I quit drinking on my own. And I wound up having an alcoholic seizure, and wound up back in the hospital, that same hospital. And, you know, I told them what I did, and I said, I quit, you know, I quit drinking. And, you know, the doctor said, no, you need to quit drinking, but you need medical help. You know, you need to go to treatment. And I didn't know nothing about that. So they told me where to go, and it was Austin Recovery, and this was when it was over on MLK. And I show up there early, and, you know, by this time I figured out that, you know, the DTs would go away if I drank some. So I brought a six-pack with me just in case this treatment, whatever it was, didn't work, you know. So, I mean, I was totally oblivious to this stuff. I remember my admissions counselor is a member of my home group now. And I remember seeing him for the first time at my home group, and he goes, Tony, the only one more honorary here than me is you. And I remember going in there, and I was thinking going in that it was going to be a shot in an arm. You know, they give me a shot in the arm and then send me on my way, or give me a prescription to go fill. And, you know, I thought that was treatment. I thought that was it, you know. He started talking about 28 days, and I was like, what? No way. You know, I remember there was some cussing, and I remember Jim's face being beet red. And, I mean, the final straw for me was when they wouldn't let me bring my girlfriend with me. Yeah, that was it. I didn't want to come. I was like, no way. And, you know, I remember it took so long, we took a lunch break. You know, I got there early. I found out later that I was Jim's first client, I guess. And we took a lunch break and came back. And, you know, he finally eventually talked me into it. I mean, I was so far from reality that, you know, I've been doing things so wrong for so long that it was the only normal way. It says that in the book, you know, my way of thinking, the alcoholic way, was the only normal way. And, I got in, and, you know, they got me on detox meds and safely detoxed me, and that was my first time through treatment. I like to read this out of the doctor's opinion. And one other thing, I don't have the book with the dust cover on it, but hold on. I wish they had this in more of but anyway, this is where I find it. In the dust cover of Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book, it says, the basic text, pages 1 through 164, which has been the foundation of recovery for so many alcoholics, remained and still remains unchanged. It says basic text up here also, font title of the, you know, the big book, A members font title of their basic text. A textbook is meant to be studied, you know, so, I mean, you just don't read it once and then call it good. Because I've been around here since 2002, and I continue to read this. I go to Big Book Studies like every week. And I'd like to read this out of page XXVIII down at the bottom. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the truth from the false. To them, the alcohol life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontent unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. You know, I totally identified with that, you know, when I first read that. When I take sponsees through the book, I start them out on a doctor's opinion, and basically that's step one. I mean, if you can identify with that phenomena of craving, that is not with the average tempered drinker above that. The phenomena of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker. So what that means is the phenomena of craving only exists in the alcoholic, not the average person. I definitely had that phenomenon of craving and identified with that to the fullest. I mean, today I got a, my story is basically, you know, the same as everybody else. It's probably a little more extreme, you know, being in Vegas and everything, but, you know, I knew from a young age that I was alcoholic, but I didn't want to quit because I knew eventually one day I would, but it wasn't going to be that day, you know, because I was having way too much fun. You know, today I got a home group. I got a sponsor. I sponsor three guys. I've got two guys, Sam and Scotty. They're both coming up on 2 years now. And that means more to me, giving them their tips on birthday night means so much to me. You know, out of bad things, you know, it's like a paradox in AA, you know, bad things are like the best things in the world. You know, my Skid Row alcoholic story, you know, has the power to save another man's life. And that is pretty awesome. But, you know, I got a home group, I got a sponsor, three sponsees, I got a new guy, he's got like 2 months, he's so on fire with this, I call him my AA butterfly, he's just bouncing around, it's good to see that, you know, he's real ambitious. I mean, he's jumping into this with 2 feet, you know, and it's awesome to see that. I got a commitment at my home group. I do service work. I'm on the steering committee. I do treatment centers. I've gone to a few treatment centers and told my story. Let's see. Yeah, this is part of my recovery, coming out here and telling my story. And you know, I got to keep that in the forefront, you know, because it says in the book, you know, we have a long road of reconstruction ahead. And, you know, when I start thinking that that construction is near finished or done, that's when I usually start backsliding, you know. And this last relapse I had was pretty bad. It's basically I wasn't working no program. My mother passed away December 22nd. You know, the holidays were coming up. I had a relationship problem, and, you know, I lost a job all within, like, 2 weeks. And, You know, I just took off to drinking, and you know, having some sobriety. You know, my first go at this, I got four and a half years. You know, and I knew the program worked. It's just that I quit working it. I quit enlarging my spiritual life. That was the result. I mean, so, you know, I wound up relapsing. I was drinking vodka every day for 23 days till I passed out, waking up, drinking again. An old sponsor of mine came and dug me out of my hole. And he was my very first sponsor, bought me my first big book. And came and dug me out of my hole and took me out to eat. We were eating, and it was breakfast. You know, I still respected the man, even though I was on a, you know, a death mission. And, you know, he was telling me, you know, we were talking, and, you know, I was telling him, you know, all the woes of my life, you know. And, you know, he told me, he said, "Tony, you're worth saving." And that kind of hit me hard because, I still respected this man even though I was in the state I was in, you know, and I'm like, no, you don't understand, you know, I'm on a mission here. This is, you know, not going to go that way, you know, in my mind, you know, but I had so much respect for this guy and he just, I mean, he got me into Shoal Creek somehow. I remember getting there and like crying, you know, the first friggin' 2 days I was there. And, you know, and this had to be my higher power talking to me. It just came into my mind, you know. Your mama wouldn't want you drinking yourself to death. And, you know, I had a moment of clarity right there. I mean, I was still coming out off of alcohol. They kept me 10 days there. They normally keep you like six and... You know, it was pretty bad. But, you know, I made up my mind right then and there that I was either going to work this program to the fullest or I was going to go back out and finish the job. Because I wasn't going to waste my time and I wasn't going to waste anybody else's time. That's where I was at. So, I mean, I've fully committed. And, you know, that's what it takes for me. You know, I got to stay connected to this program. I got to continue to give back what was freely given to me on a daily basis. And, you know, today I'm pretty aware and awake and you know, sobriety is awesome. I have a relationship with my higher power, which is, I know, you know, the newcomers are not going to know what that means or anything, you know, but I mean, it's like shit happens and I see it and I'm like, damn, that's my higher power. Well, this time about this time last year, I had the opportunity to go down to Victoria after Hurricane Harvey hit, and me and a buddy, I mean, he's got 11 years and he's in sobriety, and his brother owns a roofing company, and we went down there. We had the opportunity to go down there and be of service, you know, and we got to drying in some roofs. I mean, there was shingles missing, and we were driving people in and making sure their roofs didn't leak anymore, and they were happy to see us, and it was pretty awesome. We wound up going to a meeting down there, and the meeting we went to was called Unity, and I think it was at the Unity Church down there, and there was like 20 people there, you know, and me and my buddy, we come in, and, you know, it seemed like a normal meeting. These people were smiling, and you know, they had a glow about them, and, you know, we sat down and had a meeting, and, you know, they were talking and they were saying, you know, well, you know, I've lost, you know, my house, you know, and my clothes, but, you know, my kids are okay. My wife is okay. You know, we're going to make it, you know, and there was this, there was this guy in there. He had lost everything. All he had was the clothes on his back, and he's at an AA meeting asking if he could help any of those at the meeting out. And I was like, you know, it took me pretty hard, you know, because I was thinking, damn, you know, these guys lost everything they owned. And, you know, they put it into perspective. They told me it's just stuff, you know. And I remember coming in, you know, and thinking, well, I can't get sober if I don't have this, if I don't have that, you know. That's crazy, you know. The gift of sobriety is the biggest gift I've ever received. My life has changed in so many ways, but I was aware and awake enough to see that in those people down there. You know, seeing God doing for them what they could not do for themselves. I was truly blessed to be a part of that. And, I mean, that was a really big and, you know, in my sobriety. So no matter what, you know, I've had some bad things happen to me in sobriety also. I was about 6 months sober, and I was living in a sober house. And, I mean, there was a guy there that was pretty strung out, and, you know, the owner didn't want to throw him out because his parents were paying his way, and, you know, I think they were paying a little extra. But anyway, he came at me one night, you know, just out of the blue. And, you know, we wound up getting into a fight, and then, you know, the police were called. And, you know, the police got there, and basically it was self-defense. I had two guys there that told the police officer that it was self-defense. And the police officer ran us both. And I guess they saw my record, you know, compared to this other guy's record. You know, they decided to take me. And, of course, they looked at him, and he was a little worse for wear than I was, so they wound up taking me to jail, and I was in jail for 3 months. And I remember getting to jail, and I'm like thinking, well, this can go one of two ways. I can come in here and put, you know, the Superman cape on, you know, and be a gladiator and everything else, and try to run the show and become the old Tony and everything, or I can turn this into a positive situation. So, you know, I took, you know, the right route. You know, I became, you know, the leader of the prayer circle in there, and was looking for other alcoholics to help out in there. And I worked with three guys. One of them today is in the program, and that's pretty friggin' amazing, you know. So I continued to work the program even when I was locked up, and the worst thing possible in my mind could happen, you know. But now that I look back on it, it was like, wow. You know, I made it through that. You know, and I was found innocent after that too, you know. And and you know, I could have went after the state and, you know, got money, and, you know, that same voice popped into my head, you know, the one that said your mother wouldn't want to see you drink yourself to death. And this time it said, what about all those other times that you did shit that you didn't get caught doing? And I started thinking, well, they would still have me locked up, you know. And so, you know, I kind of put that in like an, well, that's a way, wait a minute, I can use that like an amends, you know. All right, I put that 90 days in there on the amends side. And it works for me. I mean, I feel like, you know, I do. I mean, I still owe society an amends, you know, for the many years of being on the other side, you know. So if I continue doing what I'm doing, I'm going to continue to stay sober, and it's like a living amends, you know, passing it on. And, you know, I'm blessed. I run my own little business today. You know, I'm able to hire other people. People call me up and want me to come do work for them. You know, I still have yet to advertise, you know. This rain, it's been, I think it's been raining for like 3 weeks, or 2 weeks or something like that, at least 2 weeks. Well, all this work that I've been doing this last 2 weeks has been inside work. I haven't gotten zero outside work. And it's not because I've been looking for it. And it's stuff like that. I see that happening in my life, and I'm like, that's not a coincidence, man. That's God winking at me. You know, that's God being there, you know. And recovery's great, you know. But, you know, I look at all the, you know, things that have been the worst things that happened in my life. In recovery, God turns them around into great things. You know, like being in jail, man, and staying sober. And through that, you know, I look back on it and I say, man, if I can stay sober through that, I can stay sober through anything, you know. It's pretty awesome. What does life look like today? I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, I make meetings. My first sponsor I was telling you about that bought me my first big book and got me through the steps recently passed away. And he was a big contributor to this place. And I mean, he was a big inspiration to me. He was a great man. He had over 33 years of sobriety. And, you know, I used to see him every week at a big book study. That many years, still going to, you know, big book studies. And giving back was freely given to him, you know. And just still being an inspiration to me. You know, those are the people I hang out with. You know, I got a support group of people that when they see me getting sideways or whatever, they'll call me out on my shit, you know, and it's the same way around. Well, there was a couple guys that I hadn't seen for a while, and I'm talking, oh my gosh, 14, 15 years, and they're still sober. Hold on. And they showed up at my home group. And I was glad to see them, you know, and I'm telling them about, you know, everything I've been doing and in sobriety and all. And, you know, one of the things I've done in, you know, 2010, me and another person helped put together the 12 and 12 meeting, which is called Cherry Creek now, 12 at 12. And, you know, it's become the biggest meeting in Austin today. It's pretty awesome. I mean, it all started because, you know, I had a resentment over at the other group I used to attend. I won't mention it. And, you know, you know, there was just, you know, it was just not doing it for me. So someone suggested, you know, go start your own meeting. And I was like, I will. And, you know, so basically I was talking about it to a friend, and they kind of put the wheels on it. And you know, I wanted it to be recovery-based, you know. I wanted it to be a topic meeting. I wanted it to, the topic to come out of the big book, or the 12 and 12, and you know, it's pretty awesome. It's a God thing, you know. I tell them at that meeting, I was like, this is, you know, I mean, it is a God thing, because I didn't bring all you crazy people together, you know. So, you know, I was telling my friend this, you know, yeah, I started this meeting, you know, and this other meeting, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. And then one of my buddies was standing there on the sideline that's in my support group, and he said, well, where's God in all that? And I was like, oh man, all right. And then he just walked away, you know, dropped the bomb on me. And I was like, well, yeah, it's all God, you know. I give him all the credit, because I'm the type of alcoholic, if I have a craving, you know, I'm gonna be down at that corner store drinking, you know. I'm not gonna be sitting around the meetings white knuckling it until somehow somebody sprinkles some magic dust on me and I'm cured, you know. It doesn't work like that with me, you know. I had to get on my knees and ask my higher power to relieve me of my phenomenal craving for alcohol. And it happened, you know. You know, but I know there's some things I got to do on a daily basis to maintain my sobriety. You know, number one thing when I wake up in the morning, because every day is a gift for me. Everyone I drank with, my drinking buddies, the last one, he died in 2007. So, you know, and they drank just like me. You know, I drank just like them. You know, so I look at it like that. You know, that's where I should be if I wouldn't have quit drinking. So, you know, every day is a gift. And every day I wake up, you know, I thank my higher power and I ask him to help me stay sober today. And then, you know, of course, throughout the day, I do prayer and meditation. Usually in the morning I meditate because my mind is empty and it's better. It's not filled with the junk throughout the day at work and all the things that days will bring into your mind. So it's easier for me to meditate in the morning, and then at night when I stay sober throughout the day, you know, I give thanks. I say, thank you for keeping me sober today. And that's on a daily basis. And one of the, and you know, I'm afraid to miss that, you know, because I've been doing it for so long that, you know, I get scared. I'm like, damn, I missed that, you know. And today I'm able to catch myself before I start getting all sideways, you know. When stinking thinking and the old Tony starts flaring up, you know, I'm able to identify it. And, you know, I have safety blocks, you know. I'll, you know, pause when agitated. I know when I get agitated. I used to be the hottest head in the, oh my gosh, I used to get mad all the time over crazy little things. And I had a good sponsor, and he would put me in check a lot, you know. And he would tell me, look, you know, this is how it is. You can't be like that, you know. Resentment, you got to forgive. You know, resentment is the number one offender. And, you know, I was like, but you can't do that. You can't get away with it. You know, and, you know, I was the worst. I don't know how they got me to see this, but, you know, I know when that recorder starts going in my head, you know, and I start getting a resentment, even if I'm right, doesn't mean I have to make it into, you know, a big stink and everything, you know. So I'm not on a debating bus anymore. You know, I know when that recorder starts playing in my head and I start sliding down the crazy tunnel, you know, I know I got to pause, and I'm able to catch that today and put the brakes on it before I wind up having to do some writing and having to make amends. One of the biggest things I learned about amends making is I don't like to make them. You know, so it's like, you know, it's something I don't want to do. So I don't want to do anything. So I have to make amends, you know. That was what I learned the most. It's like, oh, it's all, you know, but having that feeling of, you know, a clean slate for the first time, you know. I remember when I got those amends made. Oh, my gosh. I felt like I did when I was a kid. You know, remember when you hadn't committed your first crime yet or told your first lie? Yeah, you know, and everything was like Peachy King. It was like Walt Disney World, you know, and it was wonderful, you know. Well, that's where I went after I made my amends, you know, and was cleaning my slate and didn't have to look over my shoulder and didn't have to worry about the cops putting handcuffs on me, you know, didn't freak out when a police car turned their siren on, you know, and jumped. It took a while, you know. I still had that reaction for, 2-3 years sober. I was still like, to see the lights in the rearview mirror. Oh, they got me. Wait a minute. I don't have anything on me. You know, it's like, wow. It's a miracle. But, you know, it's one of the blessings of recovery is having that clean slate, not having, you know, to be a bundle of nerves and worry about, you know, anything. Basically, I turn it all over to my higher power. And, you know, I'm getting a lot better at that. You know, things usually turn out a lot better when they're in my higher power's hands than mine. When I start taking the wheel, start trying to control other people's lives, trying to, you know, manipulate and everything my way, and you know, things don't turn out as well. Whereas if I just turn everything over and, you know, let God do his work, things happen. Like, all of a sudden I get inside work when it's pouring out rain, you know, and out of nowhere, you know, because I didn't look for it. But I'd like to thank Austin Recovery for giving me this opportunity to speak. And it's truly a blessing. It's pretty awesome being up here telling your story, you know. It's part of my recovery, you know, part of my step work, you know, 12. Try to help other alcoholics to recover. And I hope I reach someone today. But one of the things I'd like to say is, you know, meetings are a gateway to the steps and getting a sponsor. You know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are the 12 steps of AA. And because for years I would come to meetings and think, you know, after I did the steps once, that was good. I'm doing AA because I'm coming to meetings, you know, and that was it, you know. I got to continue to work these steps on a daily basis or I'll start backsliding. And another thing, I mean, it's not like I'm working them today. They've actually become a part of my life. So, you know, it's not like I've been brainwashed. Just like I said before, the brainwashing was the alcohol, you know. And basically what these steps have done for me is turned me into the person that I was meant to be in the first place. I thank you all tonight. Thank you for letting me share.